Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from Washington. Let's practice and improve our American English skills together. Today we have two stories for you. The first is about a place in Africa that is hoping people will use their animals to help solve transportation problems. Then information from Russia about a new law that aims to ban some non-governmental organizations from operating in the country. So let's get started. Here is part one of As It Is. Aid workers are urging people in the Democratic Republic of Congo to consider using animal-powered vehicles to transport goods and people. Animal traction, as it is called, is not a tradition in the DRC. But United Nations officials say animal traction could be especially useful in areas where roads are bad. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization recently sent a film crew to Imbankana, where there is a school specializing in animal traction. The organization then sent the film to North Kivu Province in eastern Congo. The UN agency is publicizing the use of animal-powered carts there because so many roads are in disrepair. Michelle Ndwako is head trainer at the school at Imbankana. He says, "We, the older generation, are soon going to depart, and we must pass our knowledge. It's useful knowledge in rural areas. Instead of women carrying heavy loads, they can tie the bullocks to the vehicle. And instead of men working with simple tools, they can use draft animals to cut the ground." On a recent day, students from Kinshasa's main state university have come to see the training. Mr. Ndwako takes them to meet two bulls. Both animals are bullocks, animals without their reproductive organs. Michelle Ndwako says experts normally suggest bullocks for animal traction, but he notes that bulls, cows, horses, and mules also are sometimes used. The animals answer to human commands. They are taught by pulling ropes that connect to rings in their noses.
Ici, nos bêtes sont dressées en langue française. Quand on dit à droite,
here, the animals are trained in French, he says. When you saw left, you pull to the left. Right, you pull to the right. Forwards, backwards, and stop. The bulls wear a wooden block that makes them move together as a team. But the animals can still hurt people with their sharp horns. Imbankana is not a rural village. It is on the main road, about 100 kilometers from Kinshasa. Local farmers mainly use tractors to prepare fields for planting. Bullocks cannot really compete here against modern equipment. It costs about the same to get a tractor and driver as it does for two bullocks and their guide to prepare 1 hectare of farmland. Teacher Diodone Chani says bullocks are used for carrying goods from outlying areas to Imbankana. He says those villages are far away, and cars and trucks rarely go there. But with animal traction, the villagers can bring their crops to the main road. On a recent visit to an outlying village, there was one broken cart along the side of the road, and another cart in the village. A local taxi driver said the vehicles had been very useful, but by 2013, they had fallen into disrepair, and no one knows how to fix them. Another problem, he said, was that the bullocks were not strong enough.
Quand vous donnez, par exemple, vous achetez le bœuf de 800 dollars, dès qu'ils arrivent là où on
taxi va... driver Jean Bosco Mbama says aid agencies provided money for the animals. The money was supposed to be spent on bullocks worth $800. But in fact, they bought animals worth $400 or $500 and kept the rest of the money. An FAO spokesman says his agency was not involved in animal traction projects in the area. In North Kivu, he says, the FAO has trained former fighters in animal traction, and its experts have provided 20 of the suggested bullocks. The South Korean government provided money for the project. The work has now ended, but the UN agency hopes to expand it. You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Russia has listed the American-supported National Endowment for Democracy as its first undesirable organization under a new law. Under the measure, the Russian government can ban some foreign non-governmental organizations when it says they endanger national security. Financing for the targeted NGOs must come from overseas. The United States Congress provides financial support for the National Endowment for Democracy, known as NED, or NED. Mario Ritter tells us more.
Russian government lawyers announced late last month that NED is banned from operating in any way in the country. They said an investigation found the group presented a threat to the constitutional order of Russia, its defense capabilities, and state security. In return, NED accused Russia of using the undesirable law to threaten and isolate Russian citizens. United States officials condemned Russia's move. The U.S. Embassy in Moscow expressed concern over the ruling's wider implications for Russian civil society. The move against NED comes several months after President Vladimir Putin approved the law. The measure gives the government extensive powers to close international organizations that it considers undesirable. A few weeks ago, Russia's upper house of parliament passed a list of organizations that prosecutors said were suspect. The list included NED and several other American NGOs, including Freedom House, Open Society, and the MacArthur Foundation. The Russian government has long accused the U.S. and Europe of using NGOs to support political unrest in countries that once belonged to the Soviet Union. It says they supported revolutions that ousted pro-Russian governments in Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, and Kyrgyzstan. 4 years ago, demonstrators filled the streets of Moscow following evidence of cheating in elections. Reports said the cheating was aimed at keeping Vladimir Putin's ruling United Russia Party in power. During the unrest, Russian officials blamed the United States and Western-financed Russian NGOs for inciting the unrest. When Vladimir Putin was re-elected to the presidency in May of 2012, new legislation was proposed. The measure required Russian NGOs to register as foreign agents for receiving money from overseas and taking part in what officials called political activities. Leading civil society activists say the term foreign agents is similar to being accused of treason. They have tried unsuccessfully to change the term through Russia's courts. The Committee to Prevent Torture is a long-time Russian human rights group. Its director, Igor Kalyapin, accused Russian officials of using the foreign agents law as much as possible in an effort to please the government. He says, I know the history of my country. I know that when these types of repressive measures appear, there is competition. And now, he says, the competition is to see who can find the most foreign agents. I'm Mario Ritter.
This is VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The International Monetary Fund says sanctions linked to the crisis in Ukraine could end up hurting Russia's economy. The IMF says the sanctions could lead to a 9% drop in Russia's gross domestic product, or GDP, the yearly value of all its goods and services. The Russian economy shrank over the past year because of Western measures aimed at punishing Russia for its actions in Ukraine. Russian measures against the West also hurt the economy. In addition, low prices for oil exports increased pressure on the value of Russian money and the country's finances. Now, the Russian economy is showing signs of stabilization. The economy no longer appears to be as weak as it once was. Last year, Western countries ordered restrictions that limited financing for major Russian banks and energy companies. The West also restricted high technology exports to Russia's energy industry. In reaction, the Russian government banned imports of most Western food products. The International Monetary Fund estimated the immediate effect of sanctions and Russian actions against the West reduced Russia's GDP by up to 1.5%. The IMF said its estimate rose to 9% over the next few years. But IMF officials said their findings were based on economic models and they could change. The IMF also predicted weak economic growth of about 1.5% a year in Russia over the next few years. The economy was growing about 7% a year before the world financial crisis in 2008. The IMF said slow-moving structural reforms, sluggish investment, and adverse population dynamics are all part of the picture. It urged Russia to reduce the involvement of the state in the economy, protect property rights, and increase competition. The IMF said Russia would return to economic growth next year as a weaker value for its money increased competitiveness and overseas demand increased. It also predicted that financial conditions in the country would normalize. The fund also predicted a growth rate of 0.2% next year, following shrinkage of 3.4% this year. Inflation was predicted to slow to about 12% by the end of this year, and then 8% by the end of next year. The IMF praised the central bank's policy of reducing its main interest rate in line with underlying inflation. But it added that the rate of reduction needed to be prudent. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
from VOA Learning English. This is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we look at the start of the American Revolution. The road to revolution in the late 1700s took several years. There were protests against the British policy of taxing the colonies without giving them representation in Parliament. To prevent trouble, the British sent thousands of soldiers to Boston, the largest city in Massachusetts. Jane Gordon, the Director of Education and Public Programs at the Massachusetts Historical Society, explains the mood at the time.
We're looking at a time of great tension. We're looking at a time when there's an expectation, I think, on both sides that something will happen, but nobody knows exactly what or when.
On March 5th, 1770, that tension led to violence. It was the end of winter, but the weather was still very cold. A small group of colonists began throwing rocks and pieces of ice at soldiers guarding a public building. They were joined by others, and the soldiers became frightened. They fired their guns. Five colonists were killed. The shooting became known as the Boston Massacre. The people of Massachusetts were extremely angry. The soldiers were tried in court for murder. Most of them were found innocent. The others received minor punishments. Fearing more violence, the British Parliament removed most of the taxes on the colonists. Only the tax on tea remained. The tensions eased for a while. Imports of British goods increased. The colonists seemed satisfied with the situation until a few years later. Then the Massachusetts colony once again became involved in a dispute with Great Britain. The trouble started because the government wanted to help the British East India Company. That company organized all the trade between India and other countries in the British Empire. By 1773, the company had become weak. The British government decided to let the company sell tea directly to the American colonies. The colonies would still have to pay a tea tax. The Americans did not like this new plan. They felt they were being forced to buy their tea from only one company. Officials in the colonies of Pennsylvania and New York sent ships from the East India Company back to Britain. In Massachusetts, the British governor wanted to collect the tea tax and enforce the law. When the ships arrived in Boston, some colonists tried to block their way. The ships remained just outside the harbor without unloading their goods. On the night of December 16, 1773, a group of colonists went out in a small boat. They got on a British ship and threw all the tea into the water. Destroying the tea was a serious crime. The colonists were dressed as American Indians, so the British would not recognize them. But the people of Boston knew who they were. A crowd gathered to cheer them. That incident, the night when British tea was thrown into Boston Harbor, became known as the Boston Tea Party.
And all of a sudden, with the Tea Party, they say, enough is enough.
Gordon Wood, a history professor at Brown University in Rhode Island, says the Tea Party made Britain furious with the colonies. Parliament reacted by passing a series of laws that punished the whole Massachusetts colony for the actions of a few men. One of these laws closed the port of Boston until the tea was paid for. Other laws strengthened the power of the British governor and weakened the power of local officials throughout the colonies. The laws were called the Coercive Acts. Historian Gordon Wood says they helped unite all the colonies against Britain, even though not everybody approved of the Boston Tea Party.
The Virginians are appalled at the Tea Party. They just think that's just terrible, destruction of all that property. But when they see what the British do, the Coercive Acts, they say to themselves, if they can do that to Massachusetts, the British can do that to us. And they're on board. And that really is the turning point.
In June of 1774, Massachusetts called for a meeting of delegates from all the other colonies to consider joint action against Britain. This meeting was called the First Continental Congress. It was held in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in September of 1774. All the colonies except one were represented. The southern colony of Georgia did not send a delegate. The delegates agreed that the British Parliament had no right to control trade with the American colonies or to make any laws that affected them. They said the people of the colonies must have the right to take part in any legislative group that made laws for them. The First Continental Congress approved a series of documents that condemned all British actions in the colonies after 1763. The delegates approved a proposal by Massachusetts saying that the people could use weapons to defend their rights. They also organized a Continental Association to boycott British goods and to stop all exports to any British colony or to Britain itself. Local committees were created to enforce the boycott. One of the delegates to the First Continental Congress was John Adams of Massachusetts. Years later, he would say that by the time the meeting took place, the American Revolution had already begun. King George II announced that the New England colonies were in rebellion. Parliament made the decision to use troops against the colonists in Massachusetts in January of 1775. The people of Massachusetts formed a provincial assembly and began training men to fight. Soon, armed groups were doing military exercises in towns all around Massachusetts and in other colonies. British officers received their orders in April 1775. By that time, the colonists had been gathering weapons in the town of Concord, about 30 kilometers west of Boston.
It's a gentle landscape. There are no great mountains. There are no great valleys or waterfalls. It's a gently rolling hillside farm landscape. There are two rivers that come together to form another river.
Jane Gordon from the Massachusetts Historical Society lives in the area. She describes what the scene must have been like.
The houses are mostly made of wood. Many of them are not painted. In April, the leaves would just be budding out. Things would be greening up. And actually, the first day of the revolution was a very warm spring day.
The British forces were ordered to seize the colonists' weapons, but the colonists were prepared. They knew that the British were coming. Years later, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem about what happened. The poem is about Paul Revere, one of three men who helped warn the colonial troops that the British were coming.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One, if by land, and two, if by sea. And I on the opposite shore will be, ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm."
When the British reached the town of Lexington, they found it protected by about 70 colonial troops. These citizen soldiers were called Minutemen. They had been trained to fight with only a minute's warning. Eight colonists were killed. Each side accused the other of firing the first shot in that first battle of the American Revolution. It became known as the shot heard round the world. From Lexington, the British marched to Concord, where they destroyed whatever supplies the colonists had not been able to save. Other colonial troops rushed to the area. A battle at Concord's North Bridge forced the British to march back to Boston. It was the first day of America's War for Independence. When it was over, almost 300 British troops had been killed. Fewer than 100 Americans had died. The British troops had marched in time with their drummers and pipers playing Yankee Doodle. A Yankee Doodle was a man who did not know how to fight. The song was meant to insult the Americans, but in the end, they were very proud of it. Following the battles at Lexington and Concord, the Massachusetts colony organized a group that captured Fort Ticonderoga. This was a British position on Lake Champlain in New York. The other colonies began sending their own troops to help, and another meeting was called, the Second Continental Congress. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.